Our next presenter is Gary Mandel. He's worked with Sony Professional Solutions Groups for more than 26 years, and it's in the development and marketing of new display products. And his primary focus right now is on OLED display technology, but he's also worked on CRT technology, projection technology for theaters, and LCD technology. He's also worked on CCD sensor development, and he holds three patents. And the most interesting patent he holds, I thought was pretty interesting, the microwave turntable. He holds the patent for the microwave turntable. I said, the next time I use my microwave, I'm going to tell my wife, I know who invented this. He's a member of SMPTE and IEEE. So, Gary, it's all yours.
All right, thank you. This is the first time I've been to this, and I've been told I'm very delinquent, that it was a very worthwhile place, and so far this has just been wonderful. I'm a senior product manager for display products. Normally, these are the products that are sold into broadcasting or into film production. And what we'd like to talk about is a new development that we've just come up with. It's called OLED, Organic Light Emitting Diode. And in a nutshell, what this is an emissive technology. When we talk about LCD, is a transmissive technology where we're running light through a device. Plasma, CRT, are emissive technologies similar in the way that they generate light. And OLED is the same way, is it actually makes its own light. So because it makes its own light, there is no backlight system. There is no gas system. In a plasma, the operation of that is by exciting a gas and turning it into a plasma. We don't do anything like that. It's in theory, it's a much simpler type of technology. However, in fact, to do it is much harder than it sounds. It's a self-luminous matrix array. So when you look at it as a panel, the entire panel is the entire device as you pick up this panel. There is no external parts to it. It simply looks like a piece of glass. And when you put charge into it, light comes out of this very thin device. The way it's done is we are actually sandwiching special materials to do a process called recombination. And it's simply a matter of layering these materials correctly that we can do this process. The process that we're doing is electroluminescence. And essentially what we're doing is we're just making a conversion of electricity into light. And we do this in a process called recombination. As we pass current into this device, which is very, very low, by the transport of the current through the materials, it makes light. I don't know if you guys seen it on YouTube. MIT has a great demonstration. They basically take two nails, they put it into a pickle, and plug it into the wall, and the pickle lights. It's a very crude demonstration, but it's pretty effective of the same type of process. What we're going to do is we're going to take these electrons and we're going to inject them into one side of the device. We're going to take holes and we're going to inject them into the other side of the device, and we're going to do this recombination. Now, everybody goes, it's organic. So obviously it's made up of apple peels and oranges and grass and other things you find around your yard. It actually is a little more complicated than that. But the other thing is it's not a semiconductor. And this is really a huge part of how this device works. If we're working within a semiconductor, is crystalline. It's using a very fixed, hard matrix. It has a very large binding energy, radiuses of over 100 angstroms. So it covers a number of molecules. What happens in this is it gets the molecular structure of this is very uniform, it's organized, and it gives it the strength, it gives the crystal the strength. What we're doing is we're using organic materials, and this is called Frenkel excitation. What this is the binding energy is limited to a molecule area. And so the radius is only about 10 angstroms. And what this does is our mobilities, our carrier mobilities of moving charges through these materials uses a lot less current. It's a lot more efficient. What can happen is we can jump charges across the structure much easier than we can through a semiconductor. The other thing is this graphic's a little, it's not quite accurate. Where this is an organized lattice, this is basically a very unorganized. This is a set of molecule groups, combination of chains, but it is not really organized. So organic conductors, why are we doing this? Probably one of the biggest things is in the orbitals of the atoms used in these materials. When you think of a typical atom and the electrons and particles orbiting around it, you kind of think of the Earth with a bunch of satellites. And they go in all kinds of different directions, and you have vertical orbits, and you have horizontal orbits, you have them all over the place. This is different. Basically, we're looking in two or four planes of orbitals where the electrons will orbit horizontally. And what this does is we can divide these apart within these materials. Again, like we talked about, is the molecules have very weak binding forces, so the control of this is much easier to do. Something very different in these materials is the even field uniformity. When we think about a semiconductor and we think about electricity going through it, you kind of think of a lightning strike. Is there's a single path that goes through the material, it's controlled within that material, but it's limited to a certain range of molecules within the material. That doesn't work with us. If we use that type of material, what's gonna happen is we aren't gonna energize enough atoms or enough of these molecules, and we won't get enough light out of it. So these materials are designed so that this process is like a wave or a uniform change of charge as it goes through the material. And this is a very, very precise, a very special process. Mobility is about 1 centimeter per volt seconds, which is it's probably 10 to the minus 10th smaller charge than what you were seeing in a CRT. Foral efficiencies are much higher. For the amount of charge we can put into this material, for the amount of light that comes out of it, has very, very high efficiency. So we can get quite a bit more light out than, say, out of maybe a standard phosphor. Epitaxy fabrication. When I'm making a crystal, I have to grow that crystal. And to grow that crystal usually takes a lot of high pressure and a lot of temperature. And if we're building semiconductors, we use a lot of high temperatures in the process to fabricate these crystal structures. Where the downside is we're limited to materials that only can handle these high temperatures. This actually has the ability of using much lower temperature properties and adds a whole new dynamic to what we can do with these devices. Now, here's the word for today. We have HOMO and LUMO layers, and I want to talk a little bit about that. We're going to have, in the material structure of these things, we have what are called high occupied molecular orbitals, low unoccupied molecular orbitals. Meaning that in these orbitals on these atoms, what is happening is in the higher order, we are going to have electrons. In the lower orders, we're not. We're going to have holes. And we have to control this within the molecule. And the types of materials will not allow bonding or the transition of the higher order orbits to occupy the lower unoccupied orbits. Whereas we have other materials in there that make that very easy. And I'll get into that in a little bit. So that's kind of the basic opening of what this is. But also too, you know, everybody, this has been an ongoing thing for quite a while. And I kind of wanted to get a history before we get into the meat of this. What's really interesting is in 1965, was the start of this when the Sigmatron showed basically a set of polymers with a single junction that would light. And this was an offshoot of LED technology and research at that time. What I thought was also interesting is this is 1965. LCD development really didn't even start to happen until 1970. So this is actually an older technology. And then nothing happened. between 65 and 87, it really kind of went away. No one really took any attention to it until planar decided that they wanted to give it a shot again. And what this is thin film electroluminescence. This is actually not quite OLED yet. This is basically taking two pieces of plastic, bonding them together, and getting light out of it. However, there were a lot of issues with that. In 87, at the Society of Information Display, there was a paper by Tang and Van Slyke, basically described the possibility of, if we took these layers and we built this device this way, we could make a picture out of it. And this is the birth of, or the first real descriptions of, or ideas of OLED. In 93, planar came out with a multicolored thin film electroluminescent. In 97, iFire gave it a shot with a thick film, a little bit different idea, but still basically the same type of technology. 99, Pioneer showed a polymer-based OLED. And this again goes back to the temperature issues with using a silicon device, is we can use plastics now in the fabrication of this, which now adds a whole new dynamic to the display. This is a picture of Imagine's SVGA display. Those are postage stamps. So you can kind of get an idea where things are starting. You can see here, this is just a standard circuit board behind it. Kodak jumped into it with their cameras in 2003 with a 2.2-inch. Kodak actually didn't really say much until they went into manufacturing and started making panels. And we're one of the first ones to actually, or I think we're the first ones to deliver a product actually using OLED. In 2004, people started thinking about TVs. Seiko Epson jumped into it and showed a 40-inch panel, and soon afterwards, as a Me Too type of answer, Samsung did too. And then the Chinese company, AOU, starts production at 2.2, which you start seeing in cell phones. In 2006, a really huge development, a Japanese company, Koizumi, comes out with OLED, but used for lighting. And this is a replacement for fluorescent lights because of the efficiency of OLED. And then probably one of the biggest things in 2009, Mitsubishi demonstrates a tiled 155-inch OLED. So while we're still working kind of smaller, it has been demonstrated up to the sizes of even what you're seeing on the largest plasmas. And then in 2009, Osram jumps in and actually starts making real lamps. And these are lamps you can buy in the store that replace fluorescent lamps. Where we jumped in is in 1994, and that's where we started doing our development. So 17 years ago. I was just talking to Gary a little bit about why some manufacturers stick with the technology. And this is pretty much the reason, is you have a time of investment between 1997 to where we're actually delivering product now. So it's taken 17 years in order to get there. So when you make a display technology decision, you really got to stick to it. In 2001, CTEC is a display technology convention in Japan. We showed a 13-inch SVGA color. That's this guy here. And then in 2003, we jumped in. We took about a $90 million investment, and we started doing a small OLED manufacturing. The plant opened up in 2004 at a capacity of about 100,000 units a year, and we came out with a little PDA device that was sold in Japan that actually used this OLED. 2008, we jumped in again. We had shown some sizes as demonstrations up to 27-inch. But in 2008, we started delivery of the 11-inch. I don't know if everybody saw the XEL. It was a little 11-inch TV that was fed by two HDMI inputs. This is what it looked like. One of the big things we showed off with it was you could see how thin it is. It was basically the entire panel was about less than 3 millimeters thick. And we decided that we were going to go in whole hog, and we made a $200 million investment into a manufacturing plant in Nagoya that is building the panels that we're selling right now. In 2010, We started delivering professional product with a 7.4 inch. The other thing that we did is at CES, we showed 3D on OLED using active glasses. So that's kind of the history of it. You can see that no one has been able to do this very quickly, and it's certainly not an overnight process. This is basically two basic synoptics of how it's built. You'll have a panel substrate, typically for what we're doing is glass. We'll have a driver layer. In this driver layer is usually thin film transistors, TFTs, almost the exact same design as what's used in an LCD. But these are on a layer separate from where the actual pixel is. We'll have an anode, which will inject holes. We'll have a transport layer to move those holes. We'll have a cathode on the face to inject electrons. We'll have a transport layer to move those electrons. And in the center, we'll have an emission layer, which actually makes the light. This is a little simpler idea, but you can see here we inject electrons, here we inject holes, and these are layers bring them to a center area to make the light. This is a picture of our 25-inch panel. I wish I had one more on edge, but it's about a 16th of an inch thick with everything in it. So basically, the mechanics of this are pretty simple. We have what are called host materials, and these reside in the electron transport layer and the hole transport layer. And what they're going to do is they're going to move the charges. So you kind of look at these as conveyor belts. In our HOMO area, we're going to bring in charges through our electron transport layer, and then as these exit, we'll have a LUMO layer, which brings the holes out. And then we have just the opposite down here, in that where we move the holes up into the emission layer, and then we transport out electrons back out from that layer. So these will hop molecule to molecule in the host areas. These molecules have very large boundary areas, so they won't allow the recombination. In these materials, I can't have the electron jump back down into a whole area. It'll forbid it. It won't let that happen. So it just simply moves them molecule to molecule. So what's going to happen is I'm going to get to the end of the chain. In the emission layer, I have both host and I have guest molecules. And the guest molecule will reside right at the center of where these two materials combine. And what's going to happen is when we get to the end of the chain, they're going to do this recombination, but they can't do it in their own materials. They have to do it in this guest material. So the charge transports over to this this new type of material. It goes crazy. And now it has an extra electron. It doesn't know what to do with it. It's freaking out. So the only thing it can do, it has to expel something. So it's going to choose one of the orbitals in its material. It's going to convert it to a photon, and it's going to exit out of the material. And once that happens, it goes back down to a ground state, and the whole process starts all over again. So when we talk about these things, you know, what are we talking about for materials? Like I said before, we're not using orange peels. We're not using the grass clippings. We're using organic materials. But these materials are all based off of benzene and tricycline types of materials. These are usually a six-molecule chain link. These are very tightly constructed molecule chains. Our substrate area down in here will usually be what's called system-on-glass, and we'll fabricate an electronic system on top of this glass, and that'll become this driver layer. Depending on the architecture of the pixel, we may use indium tin oxide, which is a transparent conductor, or it may also maybe be a disposition of manganese if it's going to be opaque. Typical for the whole transport layers are what are called P-dots or T-NATA types of materials. Essentially, again, these are all benzene-based types of materials. In the whole electron area, these are basically what you call, if a material could have an inverted material, that's what these materials would be. And these are more apt to control electron flow, where these are more apt to deal with the hole flow. And then the emission layer, we have what are called BTPs or PPYs, which are based on phosphors, but they have special doping in which they can work with this type of recombination. And then the cathode, again, is either would be an ITO layer or a gold manganese layer of some kind. This is where the rubber meets the road. You can think about this, it's going to be pretty simple. I get a spray can of PDOT, I spray it onto my glass, and I got a layer. And then I spray on my phosphor, and I got another layer. It's a little bit more involved. when we look at these layers, they're very thin. And we're going to measure them in angstroms. So if you think about it, an angstrom is about 0.1 nanometers. To get a kind of scale to that, when I'm looking at light, if I'm looking at blue light sits about 380 nanometers. So now I'm talking about 0.1 nanometer on this. So this is a water molecule. It's 29 angstroms in diameter, kind of to get our scale. So if we start looking at this, our whole injection area is 1,200 angstroms. If you kind of go back, we were talking about binding energies. You can figure in organic materials, binding energy is about 10 angstroms in diameter. So you can kind of back that out. This is 120 molecules thick. This would be 80 molecules thick. And this is, again, about 120 molecules thick. This one would be 2 molecules thick of how that has to be dispersed. So we're going to take these types of tolerances, and we're going to put them not only in one pixel, but we're going to put them in 6.6 million pixels over a 25-inch screen. So that's the trick. That's the big deal with doing this. Now, we can do it in different architectures. If you talk with Samsung or LG, they are also working on OLED. Their technology is using what's called bottom emission, wherein the light actually exits out the bottom through the driver area. And they've invested quite a bit to make this work. We looked at this. It has some fallacies to it. The first one is that this aperture area for the light to go through is very small. So what's going to happen is, in order to get the same amount of light, we got to drive it harder. And what happens is that shortens the life. So a lot of times when you hear that OLED dies quickly is from these types of architectures. What we're doing is called top emission, where the cathode area is transparent and the OLED area underneath it has full aperture. So if you take a microscope and you look at the panel, it's very defined square pixels on the panel. And what happens is we don't drive this as hard as we would in this type of architecture, and the panel life is increased. So we've exceeded now the lifespan of what we were getting out of CRTs with this type of technology. Now, a display is not the only thing you can do with this. Now that we are using organic materials, we can kind of go different directions. And a lot of people are looking at this for different things. One of them is called TOLED. It's transparent OLED. And so you look at it, and it's clear. It looks like a sheet of glass. And then you put a charge to it, and you can have a moving picture on this glass. Applications for this we're seeing as in heads-up displays, information displays, advertising signs, those types of things. Stacked OLED, SOLED, is this. And this is over at Osram. These are a set of lights. Now, in a display, we're going to take R, G, and B, and we're going to put them side by side so we can do different types of colors. But in lighting, we don't really care about that. So what they're going to do is they're going to stack them, R, G, and B layers, emission layers, and drive them that way. So what happens there is the output is just white light, and it's very efficient. PLED kind of talked a little bit about this. Since we don't have to use these high temperatures, we can use plastics in our backplanes instead of glass. And what this we've shown here in these PLED devices, this is a 2.5 inch. I think this is also 2.5 inch. But this shaft here is about the diameter of a pencil. And as we are rotating and wrapping this up, there's a moving picture going on the panel. This has got a lot of applications. Anywhere it's going into clothing, to lighting, to all kinds of personal types of displays. Basically, you could take almost like a piece of tape, run it on your arm, and you have a TV type of thing. As a comparison, this is the entire OLED device. So we have our back substrate, we have the OLED areas, we'll have a optical resin placed, a set of color filters. I didn't go into this too much, but there are color filters on this. These are used in a resonance cavity device that sits on top of each one of the pixels that controls the accuracy of our color. So one of the things we can do in this area between these filters and the resonance cavity is we can make our primaries basically spot on to the standards. If you go up to the monitor and you measure it, the R, G, and B values, they measure out to four places in their accuracy. But then we put the color filters in there, and then we have an encapsulating glass on top of it. And the whole device is about a 1/16 of an inch thick. And you can see again here, are the OLED areas that for the RGB areas, and then the resin and the glass. You look at this versus what we've been doing with LCD. LCD would have a backlight behind here. We have a set of polarizers that have to polarize the light. We have a cell area that includes a liquid crystal that has to actually modulate the light or move it around. And this is all very mechanical. You're building all these pieces together in the device. Where here, this is all, it just comes off right off the process as a finished device. So in theory, the cost of this, as we get manufacturing down, should be less than what it's gonna do this. This is a comparison with plasma. Again, we have quite a bit, we have a lot. ALS panels are no longer around. I guess I gotta change this graphic. But you're seeing now in the Panasonic plasmas in particular, the cell structure with individual phosphor areas, then the electrodes. Typical power operation on this runs around 100 watts on a 40-inch panel, and you're running at 200 to 300 volts. Here, we're running less than a volt, and the current draw is almost immeasurable. So we're going to do a comparison. This is a general comparison we put together. The yellow would be what we've been seeing with CRT. One of the things that CRT still does better than any other technology is viewing angle. It still has the best viewing angle. But things like weight, power efficiency, resolution, it lacks quite a bit to all the newer technologies. The blue area is where plasma fits. Plasma matches CRT in a lot of the good areas. It also is much better in resolution, but it does have some areas in weight and power efficiency where it's not as good as some of the other technologies. LCD's been very good. Display life is the best of any of the technologies. Right now, it's the highest resolution that you can get. But for professional purposes, it really doesn't work well in contrast and in black levels, and that's been the big handicap. For LCD. And then OLED, basically in a lot of areas, outperforms everything. And eventually, say resolution, that'll increase. And we see this as filling more of the outside of this this graph as we can develop it more. Contrast performance is outstanding on this. If we take white and black, and we just do a sequential measurement, so I'm gonna measure a white chart or full field white, and then I'll measure my black level. If we look at our broadcast LCD right now, it runs around 625 contrast. That's our contrast ratio. CRTs were variable depending on ambient light, but in a really good condition, they could do about 100,000 to 1 contrast ratio. OLED, one of the things about OLED is it actually turns off. And it's a very linear charge control to the pixel. So what'll happen is, if we want to go to an absolute black, we can not feed it any power, and that pixel goes to complete black. And so here, in sequential, we're almost at 1,000,000 to 1 contrast ratio. And quite honestly, that's more of a marketing term than an engineering term, because I'll show later on, the black levels of this, since we can turn it off, you actually can't measure the black level. Interframe contrast, this is an IEC test. You measure a white dot in the center of the screen or a white chip. You then go to another frame where it goes to black, but you leave white chips of similar size around the edges of where that chip was, and then you measure the black. And you can see here in the interframe contrast, we're still up around 10,000 to 1 compared to the other technologies. So even interframe contrast is better than anything. And this is where it really excels. If we follow this, this blue line is the black level that we could obtain from a broadcast. If anybody saw the BBM L231 LCDs, this is about how they performed in the very black areas. This is signal level, so 10%, 1%, down 0.1%. But about 0.14, 15 nits is about what that could achieve for a black level. CRT in really good conditions, about 10 times that, at about 0.01. But OLED, it just keeps on going, and we lose it right around here because we don't have a device that can measure that dark. So it's pretty incredible. And what this is going to give us is a lot of control, is we now have a tool in here that we can make our blacks whatever we feel we need to make the blacks. Now, what happens is we have this opportunity with having this device that can do all of this, but what we had to do is we have to relook at all the signal processing to back it up. It doesn't make any sense to have a black area this deep and you can't put any detail into it. So a lot of work has gone into the processing of our monitors right now to take advantage of this area so that you actually can see black detail in these areas. In the BVM models, it was a 7-year project to develop the chip to do this. Other things we're doing in this is we have a new three-dimensional correction system for color accuracy. And then also, too, I heard somebody this morning talking about interlace. We've knocked the interlace process down to less than 3 milliseconds so that you're almost looking exactly real time. There's no audio delay or no issue with video audio delays with these monitors for an interlace signal. If you're looking at panels, your manufacturer looking at buying panels, the panel supplier is going to give you charts that look like this. So essentially, this is time in milliseconds. This is bit level. So this is going to be opening bit levels. This is closing bit levels. And what these bars are going to show you is the time it takes to go from open to close and how it varies depending on which pixel is opening, which value you're opening, and which value you're closing at. You can see here on this LCD, the closing values are pretty high, probably over 6 milliseconds. But here, at the lower bit levels, it actually moves fairly quickly now, about 5 or 4 milliseconds. But this is taking the same values and looking at it on OLED. The OLED switches extremely quickly. So these times now, instead of being in milliseconds, are now in microseconds. And the direct advantage of that is smear in the picture. This is controlled somewhat by switching speeds and also by the type of loading into the panel and how it's controlled. But this is the type of image you're going to get off of the OLED because of the pixel speed in general. Looking at it, here is this is an NVA LCD. Basically, if we're just taking turn on, turn off values and we add them together, you'll get between 12 and 16 milliseconds, and that's pretty typical for the LCDs out there right now. If we look at CRT, this is more the profile of what you would get off of the CRT phosphor. Decay on our SMPTE-C phosphors was about 1 millisecond for red, about 100 microseconds for green and blue. But if we take that again and we look at an OLED, this is just putting a square wave into it, and we take turn on, turn off, we're running around 6 microseconds. So magnitudes faster than any of the other devices. That has good things and that has bad things. If we look at scanning on an LCD, we'll have an image and then we'll rewrite over the top of this image. And this is pretty typical for LCDs. So this is a complete overwrite of the image. What happens is because there's always an image up on screen, we're never really doing any black, you don't get any flicker. You get very used to a continuous image. But what happens is, because of this overwrite process, this is another enhancement to any type of smearing. On a CRT, it was a raster design, which was great for motion. You know, since we were just running lines across the screen, what would happen is it was very good on very fast motion, but if we go to low frame rates, like 24 frame work, what's gonna happen is it's gonna flicker quite a bit. Since this is actually faster than the CRT, we've had to balance it. So what we're doing is we'll take several hundred lines and we'll write them to the screen, and then we'll write to the line below it and turn off the line above it for black. And this gives a balance. There is still some flicker at low frame rates, but also too, the motion reproduction is very, very good. So if you look at it, this is basically a video showing LCD on this side, OLED in the center, and CRT on the edge. This should be one line, but the camera actually had some latency in it. Hopefully this works. So you can get an idea how these things scan. And it's quite a bit different process. And you can see here, we're just overwriting the same image again and again and again. We'll have this black area and sequence this down. And then on the CRT, it's just simply a line drawing on the screen. Something else, CRT, LCD, and plasma all follow the same type of constraints on color gamut. What we're looking at is kind of a graphic of the CIE, what's called 1931 chart, which shows you a range of colors a display can show. What normally you don't see, though, is how luminance affects this. And what happens on most other technologies is as you get to darker and darker images, you start constraining your color gamut. It gets less and less and less. And this is pretty typical. One of the demonstrations we've done to show this is we took a rose and we ran it through a switcher, and you simply did a fade on this rose. And as you got down into the 15, 10%, you'll watch the color leave the rose. But if you do this on an OLED, we can keep this gamut the same all the way down to black. So as you fade down on that, you're gonna see the red all the way down till you get to nothing. And it's pretty impressive. Kind of going back to a little history again, 2009, we went into full production on 7.4 and 11-inch panels. And then this year, we went into production of 17 and 25-inch panels. And we're the only manufacturer able to do this right now. What we're doing is in Nagoya, we have the one plant making the panels. And then this actually is the old CRT factory, and that's where they assemble the monitors. So we're having a 16.5-inch diagonal, 24-inch diagonal. These are 10-bit panels, HD resolutions. They're all using the top emission architecture, so they're the higher efficiency panels. The high-end series, I'll talk about in a little bit, can do a P3 color gamut. This is used in cinema and for movie production. And then this actually, I can upgrade this. We've exceeded what we were getting out of the BVM CRTs for panel life on the OLEDs. So typically now we're about 30,000 hours on an OLED panel before it gets to its half brightness state. You can't control it anymore. OLED's very thin, so this is kind of a profile of our old LCD monitor. What we had to do here, because it's, you know, LCD is transmissive, we have to have a backlight behind it to provide the light, and that will pass through the panel. But if we take the backlight and we put it up against the panel, what's gonna happen is you're gonna see a lot of uniformity problems. So we had to space the panel back and put a bunch of diffusers in there in order to make it uniform. And it took quite a bit of work, but it made this really deep cabinet, which was a real problem. With the OLED, since we don't have a backlight anymore, the panel just fits within this bezel area. And the monitor now has gone from 47 pounds down to 29 pounds. So rack mounting is one thing. This whole area used to stick out of the rack. It was pretty ugly. Now it's just about an inch thick bezel sits on top of the rack. And it makes the racking much easier. Plus you're not putting 50 pounds out there on a rack slide. The other thing is that LCD has driver areas. The road drivers reside on this side of the panel. And it made for a very thick type of bezel area. So with the OLED, there really isn't anything out here. Since the drivers are behind the panel, all the circuitry is also behind the panel. So we can make a very thin bezel. So within, just by adding a half an inch on thickness, we've gone from a 23-inch panel to a 25-inch panel. And it's a huge difference when you put them side by side. So what we've done in February of this year, we introduced the E-Series. These are the cinema monitors. Basically, they use 2K inputs instead of HD. They're working in unlimited bit levels. You can load user LUTs into these things. They have a lot of analysis functions for the QC process and film production. These are the very high-end models. But at IBC this year, we introduced the F-Series. It's essentially the same panel, a very similar engine, but it doesn't have to do all of these things. It doesn't do a lot of the operations that are critical to cinema. You know, you guys certainly don't need them. So this is about $12,000 cheaper than the cinema version, at least for the 25-inch. And it's a much more reasonable monitor for HD work. And the intention of this and the feature set of this is really intended for the broadcasting type of environment. You can kind of get a look at it. This is the 17-inch version. We have Ethernet control that goes to the control panel. You can gang these on one control panel with 30 monitors, or you can gang one monitor with 30 control panels, however you want to do it. Parallel inputs comes with 3 gig inputs, HDMI, DisplayPort, and then we have 4 option slots for different types of other features. One of them is a full rasterizer made by Harris now that plugs into the monitor, gives you waveform vector, gives you error monitoring, error logs, gamut display, which is really pretty slick. And then this is what we had here yesterday. This is the PVM line, the 7-inch, which we've been selling now about 2 years, a 17-inch and a 25-inch. Again, the way these are working is we have one set of panel fab of the 25 and the 17, and depending on how these come out of our fabrication, we will grade these. So actually, between the 3 series, it's the same panel, but what will happen is you'll see differences in uniformity, you'll see differences with some dead pixels, and those types of things, between the grades. But if you actually look at it, the E version of this, the cinema version, is a $26,000 monitor, which won't have any dead pixels. But this version here, the PVM, now we're talking $6,000. So if you can live with a little bit of that, you can save quite a bit of money. And that's what I got.
Hi, Gary. You alluded to the color gamut there, and I still want to ask the question, if we ever use these things on camera, we always have to adjust the color temperature. Is that a feature that is available in these monitors?
Yeah, and actually all the monitors now have auto setup. So actually, if I go back, it even gets better. On the 17-inch here in December, we're going to have a software upgrade. In the panel, we actually are measuring the panel on the BVM line all the time. And we measure it using a luminance measurement, and we do it with an RGB light measurement. So what you'll be able to do is select the white point you want, hit a button, and it'll align itself. It won't even use a probe. You don't have to put a probe on it. The other models, the 25-inch and the PVM line, has an Ethernet port on the back. What you can do is that ties to a software package that we can give you. It's free. And it'll tie to either a Minolta probe or a DK probe or the X-Rite probe. And it'll automatically set up the monitor.
Okay, I have another question. We have Sony LCD monitors we use for quality control now. With file transfer content, very often the files will come in with a field order reversed. So when we look at them on the QC monitor, we don't notice that. because most likely it's a progressive display. But when it hits the air, which is interlaced, it looks awful because the fields are reversed. So when, if we use this as a QC monitor, are we going to have the same problem?
No. This has, all the BVM lineup have interlaced display. It actually will display as interlaced in the correct field, and you can see it.
Okay.
So, and you can turn it on and off. And it's a special process that we have in our panel.
Was that possible in your in your LCD monitors?
In the BVM LCD, we had it, yes, but not in the PVM, not in the PVM or LCD or the LMDs.
Okay.
Because of the each pixel displaying, or depending on what's on the screen, and what content is displayed, is there a chance that there could result in some image burn-in?
OLED is emissive, so any emissive panel can burn. Now, the other thing about OLED is there are some tricks we're playing in it. One of them is we have a lot of headroom to work with in the panel. The panel works normally as adjusted at 100 nits. The panel is designed to work at 600 nits. So what we do is we control the panel, and we can also mark areas that have image burn, and we can correct it in the panel dynamically. So yes, it could burn. Say you put color bars on it and left it for 2 weeks, it's burned. But you're working normally in a normal environment. And basically we're saying treat it like a CRT. It won't burn. Even having the bugs on the screen shouldn't hurt it.
Comparing OLEDs to LCDs, could you comment on whether, which is more or less suitable for making a 3D display, either with active or passive glasses?
That's a good question. Right now, we were looking at OLED. We've demonstrated OLED actually doing active, and we showed it as an auto stereo with no glasses. We're not satisfied with it. We think we can do a lot better, so that's going to take a lot of development. It's going to be a while before that can happen. So right now, LCD is a better choice for doing that. And our results have been best with the passive systems. We think those are doing better than the active. Although if a consumer heard me say that, they'd kill me. Yes?
Hi. I was wondering if the feasibility of using OLED as a projector technology had been evaluated at all?
No. The brightness out of the OLED, I mean, the best we've done so far is, you know, in testing, no more than, say, 800 nits total. I mean, and really driving it. The problem is if you drive it that hot, the life of it is basically a linear drop. So for projection, we've kind of put our basket, we've bought into LCOS as a technology for projection. So projectors like this are using LCDs that we make down in southern Japan, and then we also have a factory making LCOS for the larger digital cinema stuff for that. It would be tough. It'd be very tough to do OLED as a projection.
How are you handling the blue dyes and whatnot for the displays? Because what I understand, the blues tend to go first in the OLEDs.
Yeah, blue phosphors. Your eye is less sensitive to blue. It only makes a very small part of the picture. So if you look at it in, basically, instead of looking at it as photometric, you look at it as a radiometric measurement, it's driven very, very hard. And it's driven harder than the other ones, the other two. So it tends to die quicker. Now what we've done is we have a special system in all our monitors where we can do a compensation to that. So what'll happen is since we have so much headroom, we'll modulate through that headroom as the phosphors decay. And what'll happen is after about 30,000 hours on the blue channel, you've lost your headroom. You're now down to, that's the best it can do. And what'll happen is it'll start losing control and it'll go away. All right. Thank you.